So if you heard a story today, right, where the hero was, I don't know, a known terrorist,
Right.
and the villains, the guys who basically left a man to die on the street, were your respected local pastors,
Wow, yeah.
you would not call that a heartwarming moral tale. I mean, you'd call it an absolute outrage.
Oh, you would be deeply offended. People would be up in arms.
Exactly. Yet that is exactly the kind of reaction Jesus was actually provoking when he first told the story we are looking at today.
Yeah, it really is.
Because, usually when we hear the parable of the Good Samaritan, like in a Sunday school classroom, there is this expectation of safety, right?
Definitely, it's safe.
It is treated like a fable, like you have the good guys, the bad guys, and a really clear moral at the end.
Right, which usually just boils down to something incredibly simple, like, be a nice person to strangers in need.
Yeah, you hear the story, you nod your head, you put the little felt characters away on the flannel graph, and you go home feeling pretty good about yourself.
Which is such a shame, because that domesticated version, it completely neuters the text.
It really does.
I mean, we naturally like things to be comfortable, right? We want things easily categorized.
Sure.
But when you actually step out of that cozy 21st century Sunday school room and step into the actual historical context of the first century,
Yeah.
well, that safe narrative landscape turns into an absolute blast furnace.
Oh, wow.
It is the literal definition of religious and political dynamite.
That is so wild. Well, welcome to today's deep dive. Our mission today is to take this text that you have probably heard, 100 times,
At least 100 times.
right, and completely strip away that sanitized greeting card version.
Exactly.
We are going to look at this story from a Christian perspective, unearthing the politically explosive, religiously shocking, hidden meanings of the text.
And we have some incredible tools to do that.
Yeah, we're crossing ancient rabbinic law with first century history, looking at the original Greek text of the Gospel of Luke, and bringing in some modern linguistic scholarship too.
Specifically drawing on the brilliant insights of New Testament scholar Dr. Amy Jill Levine.
Yes, her work is amazing. And ultimately, we want to figure out what this story actually says to you and me about our daily, very real struggles with obedience to God.
Because to Jesus's original Jewish audience, I mean, this was absolutely not a lesson in basic manners.
Not at all.
It was a deeply offensive, totally category-shattering challenge.
Okay, let's unpack this, starting with the geography of where this story actually takes place.
Right, because the setting is never an accident in these biblical
Oh,
narratives.
for sure.
To understand why this story is so shocking, we first really have to understand the intense physical and religious danger of the location itself.
Yeah, lay that out for us.
Well, Jesus specifically notes that the man was traveling down from Jerusalem to Jericho.
Which, we read that today and it just sounds like a standard commute.
Right,
Like,
yeah.
oh, I'm just driving from the suburbs into the city on a Tuesday morning. No big deal.
But it was a massive deal. It was a grueling 17-mile journey through brutal geography.
17 miles walking.
Yes, and you are dealing with a steep, rapid descent of about 3,400 feet in elevation.
Whoa, that's a huge drop.
It is. And the route takes travelers right through the Wadi Kelt, which is this winding, cavernous desert gorge.
So it's not a pleasant hike.
Not at all. We are talking about blinding heat, sharp limestone, blind corners, and super narrow passes.
And lots of places to hide, right?
Exactly. There are caves everywhere along the route, providing perfect cover for bandits. It was historically notorious for highway robbery and violence.
Yeah.
In fact, the danger was so ever-present that it was literally known in the ancient world as the Way of Blood.
The way of blood. Wow. So when Jesus says a man was walking down this road, his listeners aren't picturing a pleasant afternoon stroll at all.
Not even close.
For you listening right now, it's less like a walk through a bad neighborhood and honestly more like hiking a remote, treacherous backcountry trail known for cartel activity entirely alone.
That's a perfect analogy. The audience immediately feels this visceral sense of dread.
Yeah, you just know something terrible is about to happen to this guy.
And that dread is intentional. The setting immediately raises the stakes. And sure enough, the man is ambushed, beaten, stripped naked, and left, as the text says, half dead.
Half dead, just lying in the dirt.
Right. And the violence leaves him utterly vulnerable, which creates the tension for the arrival of the first two people who pass by.
The priest and the Levite, the
Exactly.
religious elites of the day. And here, I actually want to push back on a common modern assumption we make.
Okay, what's that?
Because we read this today, and we usually assume the priest and the Levite walked past the bleeding man because they were just, arrogant or callous.
Right, or too busy to help a guy out.
Yeah, like they were late for a very important religious meeting and just couldn't be bothered. But wasn't there a very real, intense religious struggle happening in that moment?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
They were dealing with strict Levitical law. Their hesitation was deeply rooted in a very real clash of first century religious obligations.
Tell me more about that.
Well, consider the specific condition of the victim. He is stripped naked and he's unconscious, literally half dead.
So he isn't moving.
Exactly. Now, in Jewish culture at the time, touching a human corpse caused a severe state of ritual impurity.
And that wasn't just a slap on the wrist.
No. Defilement wasn't a minor inconvenience. It was a devastating temporary exile from religious life.
Which was a massive deal if you were a religious leader.
Huge. For a priest, a Kohen or a Levite, becoming ritually defiled meant they could not collect tithes.
Wow.
They couldn't eat sacred food. They couldn't enter the inner courts of the temple.
So their whole life stops.
Basically, yeah. Their entire livelihood, their social standing, and their core religious identity were entirely tied to remaining ritually pure.
That puts it in a whole new perspective.
Right. So when they see a naked, unconscious body in a ditch, they aren't just seeing a tragedy. They are looking at a theological minefield.
Because if they touch him and he's dead, they are immediately defiled. So they run the calculation, they assess the risk, and they choose their religious purity over his life. They keep their distance just to stay clean.
But the irony here is that they didn't actually have to make that choice.
Wait, really?
Yeah, there was a massive legal loophole they ignored. What's fascinating here is a crucial detail that modern scholars point out regarding the direction of their travel.
Okay.
Jesus explicitly says they were going down the road.
Which means they were heading down from Jerusalem to Jericho.
Exactly. They were traveling away from Jerusalem.
Oh.
They had likely already completed their temple duties.
So the immediate pressure of being pure for active service was off.
Yes. Furthermore, they actually had a clear legal imperative to act.
What do you mean?
Well, rabbinic law explicitly stated that burying a neglected corpse, which was called a mitzvah, superseded all other purity laws. Yes. Even for a priest, encountering a body with no one else around to bury it meant the obligation to honor the dead overrode the requirement to remain pure.
So even if the guy in the ditch was already dead, the law actually dictated that they should break the standard purity rules to take care of him.
Exactly. But they didn't.
Wow. They completely failed to prioritize the Torah correctly.
They really did.
They chose the safety and the comfort of ritual purity over the higher, messier law of preserving human life or even honoring a dead one.
The religious leaders, the ones who supposedly knew the law of God better than anyone, completely failed to practice it when the application was ambiguous and potentially costly.
And right there is our first major takeaway when it comes to obedience to God.
Definitely.
Because we can easily look at the priest and the Levite and judge them from a distance, right? But honestly, we struggle with the exact same dynamic today.
Oh, all the time.
Like, how often do you and I choose the safety of comfortable religious rules over the messy sacrificial obedience that God actually calls us to?
It's so true. We naturally want our faith to be neat.
Right. We want to check our little boxes, go to church, keep our hands clean, and totally avoid the chaotic, bloody ditches of real life.
But true obedience to God isn't about avoiding impurity by walking on the other side of the road.
No. It's about getting your hands dirty when someone is bleeding out.
Yeah. And so the failure of the religious elites in the story creates this huge narrative vacuum.
Like the audience is just waiting for the hero to arrive.
Exactly. They're waiting for a lay Jewish hero to step up, do the right thing, and shame the priests.
Because that was kind of a common storytelling trope of the time, right?
It was. But Jesus completely denies them that satisfaction.
He goes a totally different direction.
He really does. Instead, he inserts a character whose very existence was considered an affront to God.
Which brings us to the shocking nature of the Good Samaritan.
Right.
Because today, I mean, that phrase is practically a brand name.
Oh, absolutely.
We have hospitals, charities, massive organizations, all named after the Good Samaritan. It has just come to mean, you know, a helpful person.
But to a first century Jew, the phrase Good Samaritan was an absolute oxymoron.
Total contradiction in terms.
It would have sounded entirely absurd to them. This was a centuries-old, incredibly violent blood feud.
Tell us about that feud, because it's pretty brutal, right?
It really is. Mm. Jews and Samaritans despised each other on a deeply theological and cultural level. The root of this goes back to a massive dispute over where God actually chose to dwell.
Right.
The Jews worshipped at the temple in Jerusalem, but the Samaritans believed God commanded the temple to be built on Mount Gerizim.
Okay, so a turf war over holy sites.
Exactly. Okay. And to give you some historical context.
Yeah.
In 128 BCE, the Jewish Hasmonean dynasty marched up and completely destroyed the Samaritan temple on Mount Gerizim.
They literally burned their rival's most holy place of worship to the ground.
Yes, all over a theological dispute. And the retaliation was fierce and ongoing. In fact, just a few decades before Jesus told this very story, a group of Samaritans enacted a devastating revenge.
What did they do?
They sneaked into the Jewish temple in Jerusalem right during Passover, literally the busiest, holiest time of the year.
Wow. And they didn't just vandalize it, right? I read they weaponized ritual impurity.
They did. They desecrated the sanctuary by scattering human bones all throughout it.
Human bones.
Yeah, human bones.
That is the highest form of ritual impurity, just scattered in the holy temple right before the national sacrifices.
It effectively shut down the entire religious operation.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you are a first century Jewish person sitting on a hillside listening to Jesus tell this story, and you hear that a Samaritan is walking down the way of blood and sees a helpless, half-dead Jewish man,
you are absolutely expecting the Samaritan to be the villain of the story.
You're expecting him to finish the job the bandits started.
The audience is bracing for the Samaritan to enact violence. The historical context practically demands it.
So how could Jesus use a heretical, dangerous, violently despised enemy to model obedience to God?
I mean, it must have felt like a direct insult to the listeners.
It shattered every religious category they possessed.
Totally. You can see just how repulsive this idea was by looking at the lawyer who originally stood up to question Jesus, mm-hmm. which is what prompted this whole narrative in the first place.
Oh, right. The lawyer.
Yeah. At the very end of the parable, Jesus asks this legal expert which of these three was a neighbor to the man.
And the lawyer cannot even bring himself to say the word Samaritan.
He literally chokes on the word.
He refuses to utter the name of his enemy, so he just deflects and says, the one who showed him mercy.
Right. The prejudice runs so deep that the very word is taboo in his mouth.
So we have the sworn enemy stepping into the ditch. But what actually compels him to act when the holy men wouldn't? Because this brings us to the physical nature of true obedience. And there is a brilliant, hidden scriptural callback here that just changes everything.
Yeah, to understand the mechanism of his obedience, we have to look at the original language.
Okay.
Luke, the author of this gospel, wrote in Greek. When he describes the Samaritan's reaction to seeing the bleeding man, English Bibles usually translate it politely as he took pity or he had compassion.
Which honestly sounds terribly weak.
It really does.
Took pity sounds like a fleeting, polite sentiment. Like, yeah, you're scrolling through social media, you see a sad fundraising campaign, you say, oh, how unfortunate, and then you just keep scrolling.
Right. It's just an intellectual acknowledgement of sadness.
But that's not what the original Greek word conveys at all, is it?
Not even a little bit. The original Greek word used there is splenchnizomai.
Splenchnizomai. I mean, it just sounds guttural and heavy.
It is entirely visceral. The word is derived from the noun splanchna, which literally translates to the bowels, the guts, or the internal organs.
Oh, guts.
Yeah. In ancient anatomical understanding, they didn't view the heart as the center of deep emotion the way we do in modern Western culture.
Right. We always draw little hearts for love.
Exactly. But they viewed the gut as the seat of profound feeling, grief, love, and mercy.
So we're talking about a gut-wrenching physical reaction.
Yes.
This isn't just a sad thought in your head. This is the kind of empathy that hits you so hard in the stomach that you almost feel physically ill.
Exactly. You are physically, viscerally compelled to act.
It's an obedience that starts in the very core of your body.
Yeah.
And totally overrides your logic or your fear.
It's an involuntary physical response of profound mercy. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, we find something truly incredible about how Jesus constructed this narrative.
I love this part.
Jesus wasn't just making up a dramatic story about a gut-wrenching reaction out of thin air. He was executing a highly specific callback to the Hebrew scriptures.
Basically weaponizing their own Bible against them.
Exactly.
It's like the Old Testament blueprint for the Good Samaritan.
Yes.
Because if you look at 2 Chronicles chapter 28, there is an account of a massive battle.
Right.
The northern Israelites, who historically are the ancestors of the Samaritans, had captured a huge number of Judeans, the ancestors of the Jews.
A massive hostage situation, basically.
Yeah. But a prophet rebukes the northern army for taking their own kinsmen as slaves, and amazingly, the army actually repents.
Right.
They respond by having profound mercy on their Judean captives.
The geopolitical parallels are just impossible to miss.
Totally.
Jesus is speaking to a legal expert steeped in the scriptures. This lawyer would have had these texts memorized.
And the specific actions line up perfectly. When you read 2 Chronicles 28.15, it explicitly says they anointed the captives' wounds with oil, clothed them, put all the weak on donkeys, and brought them to Jericho.
Treating wounds with oil, putting the weak on donkeys, bringing them to Jericho.
Jesus is literally checking off the boxes of that specific biblical event one by one.
He really is. Mm. Jesus is reminding this legal expert of a specific time in their own history when their bitter enemies, the ancestors of the very Samaritans they now despise, had actually shown them divine mercy.
Oh, man.
He is using their own revered history to deconstruct their current prejudice.
He's effectively saying, you know, you want to know what true obedience to God looks like. You want to know what it means to be a neighbor. Look at your own history.
Exactly.
Your enemies enacted the mercy of God better than your priests. That is a masterful rhetorical trap.
Masterful. But Jesus isn't quite done yet.
Oh, right.
He has completely deconstructed what it means to obey God by showing how an enemy enacted God's mercy.
Mm-hmm.
But the final twist of this parable is arguably the most challenging part of all.
How so?
Because it forces us to reconsider who we are really meant to identify with in this story.
Okay, yeah.
We turn here to a brilliant insight from New Testament scholar Amy Jill Levine. She points out a massive psychological blind spot that modern readers have.
What's the blind spot?
Well, when we hear this story today, we instinctively want to identify with a helper.
Well, of course we do. We all desperately want to be the Good Samaritan.
Right.
We want to be the hero who swoops in, bandages the wounds, pays the innkeeper, and rides off into the sunset.
Because identifying with the hero means we are operating from a position of power, resource, and moral high ground. We have agency.
Yeah, it feels good to be the hero. But Jesus's original Jewish audience would not have identified with the Samaritan, would they?
No, they hated him.
Right. So what does this all mean? If they don't identify with the Samaritan, who is left?
Exactly.
I mean, they wouldn't identify with the violent robbers, and they know they aren't the high status priest or the wealthy Levite.
Right.
So the only person left for the original listener to map themselves onto is the Jewish man bleeding to death in the ditch.
They are the victim, stripped of all power, all status, and all ability to save themselves.
Man, just imagine putting yourself in that ditch.
It's terrifying.
Like, imagine waking up. Everything hurts. You're bruised. You're broken. You are literally half dead.
Yeah.
You open your swollen eyes, and you realize your life was just saved. You are breathing, but then your vision clears, and you see the face of the person binding your wounds, paying your debts, and carrying you to safety.
And it is a member of a group you actively despise.
Yes. It's someone you consider a heretic, someone you consider politically dangerous, unclean, and fundamentally wrong about everything.
And yet, you are utterly, entirely dependent on your worst enemy.
The sheer vulnerability of that position is just, it's terrifying.
It really is. And this raises an important question, perhaps the most important question of the whole parable when it comes to our daily struggles with faith.
What's that?
The story isn't just asking, will you stoop down and help your enemy? That's hard enough.
Sure.
But it asks a much harder, deeper question about obedience. It asks, are you willing to acknowledge that your enemy has the capacity to be the hands and feet of God to you?
Wow. Let that sink in for a second. Because true obedience to God isn't just about offering help from a position of power, where you get to look down, feel generous, and, you know, maintain your superiority.
That's the easy part.
True obedience is about the intense humility required to receive grace from unexpected, even uncomfortable places.
Exactly.
It's acknowledging that God's grace isn't limited to the people who look like you, vote like you, or think exactly like you do.
It completely shatters our religious pride.
Hmm.
Because if we are the one in the ditch, we have to surrender our prejudice in order to survive.
We have to.
We have to admit that God can work through the very people we have totally walled off.
Wow. Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We've seen today that true obedience to God is far more radical, far more gut-wrenching, and frankly, far more humbling than a simple call to just be a nice person.
It really is. It is about prioritizing messy, bleeding human life over comfortable, safe religious rules.
Absolutely.
It is about feeling a visceral, gut-level compassion that forces you into action, overriding your fear of impurity or social cost.
And it is about realizing that we are often the ones broken in the ditch, entirely dependent on unexpected grace.
The parable doesn't just expand the definition of neighbor. It flips the script entirely on how we view our own spiritual self-sufficiency.
It really does. And we want to leave you with a final thought to mull over as you step back into your day.
Mm-hmm.
Think back to that lawyer at the very beginning of the story. He started the whole conversation by asking Jesus, "Who is my neighbor?"
Right.
And the text explicitly says he asked this to justify himself.
He wanted a theological loophole.
Exactly. He wanted a clear list of who he was obligated to help and, more importantly, who he had divine permission to ignore.
Yeah.
But by the end of the story, he was so trapped by his own prejudice that he couldn't even speak the name of the man who modeled the mercy of God.
Couldn't even say the word.
So, if Jesus were standing in front of you today, telling this exact same story to your specific community, who would he insert into that hero role?
That's the real question.
What demographic, what political group, or what rival faction would he use to represent the hands and feet of God? If you were the one bleeding in the ditch, whose face would make you choke on your words just like the lawyer did.
Mm-hmm.
The real challenge of this text isn't just about who we're willing to help. It's about recognizing the uncomfortable truth that God often chooses the very people we despise to reveal his kingdom.
So true.
Think about that the next time you see a flannel graph in a Sunday school room. The stories aren't safe, and neither is the grace they point to.